everybody, and sorry to interrupt all of that fantastic chatter. I hope you've been having some great conversations at your tables. I'm Lee Scales, and I'm UniSuper's Chief Customer Officer, and I'm actually a Mount Gambier girl, deep down, so great to be here. Thank you to CEDA for hosting today's annual panel, and to Melinda and the team for the opportunity for UniSuper to be involved. Before I begin, I'd also like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet today, the Kaurna people, and to pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging. It's been a long time since we've been able to get together in such a large group like this. It's fantastic to look out to so many faces in the room and to see some people that I haven't seen for quite a long time, particularly because I've also been in Victoria and lived through that lockdown. So there is a certain Dan over there that, you know, I don't know what he was thinking, because why wouldn't you want to come to South Australia? I certainly am looking forward to seeing my family tonight that I haven't seen for 16 months, so that's really exciting for me. So it's my pleasure to welcome you to today's Vice-Chancellor panel on behalf of CEDA and UniSuper. And I'm sure you're really eagerly awaiting to hear what the Vice-Chancellors have got to say about things that are happening in the state and the sector and more broadly. As the prophet for member super fund for the higher education and research community and their families, today's event is very topical for us as well. We're so fortunate to have a very influential and informed member base, and I'm sure that many of our members are in the room today. We're very pleased to sponsor today's panel. We have a very long-standing relationship now with CEDA, as Melinda said earlier, and it's through events such as these that we help to give our university partners a greater voice in public policy debate. At UniSuper, we're really committed to supporting events that matter to our members, and as I said, I hope that there's some of you in the room today. Particularly events that acknowledge the role of our universities in shaping Australia's future. Supporting the sector is our way of giving back to members and university partners. Undoubtedly, it's been an extremely challenging period for everybody. The outbreak of COVID affecting us all in very different ways. Anyone here today knows that the higher education sector has been especially impacted over the past 12 to 15 months. The team at UniSuper are certainly very aware of this and aware of the consequences that this has had on the sector and for our members. We really want to reiterate our support and let our members know that we're trying to do everything that we can through our various teams at UniSuper to support this environment. Australia's world-class universities play a significant role in meeting the needs of our future workforce and economic prosperity. And who better to turn to when faced with so many challenges than our universities? But the sector has faced adversity before, and it's proven to be resilient and sustainable, pivoting to ensure it remains relevant and competitive in a global context. There are very few industries and businesses who are not dependent on the success of our universities. As we navigate this period of continued uncertainty and ongoing change, there's a crucial need for connection, discussion, and the sharing of ideas, not only between universities, but with government, businesses, and the research sector. While universities play a decisive role, they can't do it alone, and collaboration on all fronts is essential. So I look forward to hearing the comments from our panellists today. I'm sure it will be very insightful and informed. So leading today's discussion is Melinda, and she's joined by our esteemed panellists, Karen Kent, Chief Executive of Study Adelaide, Professor Peter Hoy, Vice-Chancellor and President of the University of Adelaide, Professor David Lloyd, Vice-Chancellor and President, Uni SA, Professor Alvin Lowe, Vice-Chancellor, Torrens University, and Professor Colin Stirling, Vice-Chancellor and President, Flinders University. So over to you now, Melinda, to bring the panellists up, and thank you for allowing UniSuper to be involved today. Thank you.
Thanks, Lee. So I'm going to remind people to get on Pigeonhole if you are so inclined. I've already got questions rolling in, so we will share the floor and the digital technology, but if you are interested, please get on board. In a really embarrassing moment of administration, can I declare that clearly I'm not used to being out and about because I've been here for about 2 minutes and I have lost my phone. So if you find an iPhone, thanks, turn it on and there's a picture of me. Who knew? You can't take me anywhere anymore. So to kick off proceedings for the panel, I know it's really embarrassing, I'm sorry. To kick us off in our conversation, I'm going to ask Karen Kent, the Chief Executive of Study Adelaide, to come up and talk. Karen's going to talk. I'm going to sort of linger over here. We're going to get each of the panellists up and then we'll roll on to questions. So thanks.
Thanks, Melinda, and good afternoon, everyone. I'm honoured to be invited to join the Vice-Chancellor panel. I'm not a Vice-Chancellor, but I'm here to talk about international students, which obviously has a connection with all of our panellists today, and I'm very passionate about it. For over 20 years now, Study Adelaide has been promoting Adelaide as a global study destination and supporting international students in South Australia. Study Adelaide is a unique co-funded model between state and local government, the three public universities, TAFE SA, and a range of private education providers. This ensures South Australia presents a cohesive proposition to prospective students, and it has also enabled us to respond to the recent challenges in a timely and coordinated manner. But right now, there is more to be done. We want our students back. South Australia achieved a new benchmark in international education entering 2020, with back-to-back years of double-digit growth nearing 20%, meaning that our international student enrolments reached 44,000 and the sector became South Australia's largest export, valued at $2.15 billion. For obvious reasons, this momentum in growth has been interrupted. Border closures are preventing new students starting school, studying English, commencing vocational and higher education. But it is not just the pipeline of new students we are concerned about. We have an obligation to those who have already started their education journey with us, invested tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in their education in their new life in South Australia, for a qualification and lived experience that they cannot receive without being on shore to complete it. In this room, I expect that most of us understand this, and I know that many of us live this new reality every day. Given our close interaction with students at Study Adelaide, it's a reality that we hear every day. Here's one I learned about in January that stayed with me ever since. I'll call him Marcus. Marcus studies a health discipline. His story is indicative of the hope that students who were caught out by the border closure will at any moment receive the news of being able to return to Australia to resume their studies. That hope is now turning to despair. I have paraphrased and condensed Marcus's experience in the interest of time. It has been close to a year since I returned to my home country. I'm unable to do any online study as I require an onshore placement. I've lost a year of future income with this career delay and face another year's delay if I miss my preclinical in February 2021. If living through a pandemic wasn't hard enough, I have continued to pay rent, overseas health cover, and other bills for a year. I have not taken up any short-term courses or engaged in any activity requiring more than 2 months' commitment. Will our $40,000 annual fees be subsidised in consideration of the lost income and time? There is no light at the end of the tunnel when there are daily records of cases globally. Don't forget the stories of past and present students and how we are treated can affect the decisions of future students. Apparently it is safe for Zac Efron, Tom Hanks and international sports teams to fly in but not international students. We are not asking you to abandon all sense of safety and allow every international student in, but to sensibly allow international students in who cannot proceed with their studies without being on shore. We are here to be educated and equipped with what's necessary in our careers. Do you know what it is like to wake with anxiety every morning for a year to check if you are at risk of being delayed another 6 months? Of all countries available, we picked yours. If anyone questions why we, government and the sector, are focused on returning international students to Adelaide, Marcus and the 10,000 students offshore holding a student visa to study with a South Australian institution are the reason. the fact that every three international students studying in South Australia, creates one job is another reason. And because these students have other choices. Research shows that despite everything students around the globe remain committed to studying overseas. In 2021, they will change destinations rather than cancel their plans and wait another year. To places such as Canada and the UK, and in the UK where borders have effectively been opened to international students, and Canada has allowed previous students with a visa holder to enter. And research shows that perceptions of the US have been greatly improved with the change in presidential administration. No surprises there. We should be immensely proud that Australia has been the third most popular destination in the world for international students. It speaks volumes about the quality of the education, the appeal of our lifestyle, and the faith in the opportunity for individual advancement that an Australian education offers. And whether they choose to go home, becoming our advocates and lifelong connections for business and diplomacy efforts, or choose to stay and establish businesses that create jobs, support local companies to boost exports, or contribute to research outcomes at universities, we are privileged that they chose Adelaide, Australia. We want them back, and ladies and gentlemen, if it's not already crystal clear, we need them back. Thank you.
Thanks, Karen. A great kickoff to our conversations. I'm now going to ask Professor Alwyn Lowe to give us a quick update on his thinking, and then after Alwyn, we'll go to Colin, if that's all right. Thanks.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to participate in this discussion. And it's very exciting to see so many people together, and we hope we're going to see so many questions and interesting discussions. A few general remarks just to get the discussion in perspective. If we look at the higher education impact, we always depart from the perspective that it's generally accepted that higher education is a key driver in the process of national development and international development. So the argument in terms of should it be priority or not becomes irrelevant. The question is, how do you do international and how do you do local higher education effectively? History shows that significant innovation events, like the previous three industrial revolutions, positively impact the transformation of societies and radically impacted capacity in terms of, for example, manufacturing, how the political systems function, how society is structured, and we can carry on with the benefits. Disasters on the other side, like the World Wars, Black Fever, and we can go on, to a large extent created a situation where societies always had to try to move back to what they had to create stability. So we see these two opposing trends in this whole process. In this time, it is ironical that on the one hand, we see the fourth industrial revolution and we see COVID happening at the same time. So you have the idea of innovation impetus moving away from where we are, and on the other side, you have this whole process of holding back, stopping, asking the question, what is it that we need to do next? So the stopped mobility, the changed work environment, the demand for new solutions to provide and acquire services, very specific. While the fourth industrial revolution brought a number of new opportunities and ideas, new capacity to engage with these type of challenges. The exciting part is the pressure for solutions and growing needs caused a growing openness to change. So to a certain extent, COVID brought an open page, a new tabula rasa, if you want to say, here's a new page to write on. Please give us an indication where we can go with it. So higher education, in the need to position itself globally, jumped on the online, in brackets, variety online opportunities, and really started to try to deliver and keep students in the system to keep them learning. So following the technology solution, in this case, higher education positioned itself with industry and the broader society to look at the fourth industrial revolution opportunities and so on. So what should higher education institutions then do in this environment to recover? The response, technology. The response, alternative options. What should it do? It should just take a very careful look at what is busy happening in society, what is the context in which we have to position higher education. I think the first thing that we need to acknowledge is that people got used to technology. They got used to the flexibility and the openness. They will not let go easily. Higher education must learn that lesson. The economic downturn, unemployment, and the affordability of higher education. We require new jobs, we require new skills, we require new definition of opportunities. Limited mobility, the inter and intra-society impact, 1.8 billion, probably 2 billion this year loss because of the lack of demand. We're looking at changed practices, systems and processes raised new demand in a new world of work with new challenges, new opportunities. Old practices, basically not meeting the effectiveness and efficiency requirements, and for that reason, 17,300 staff out of the system. So questions about the value of higher education qualifications, very relevant at the moment. What is the ROI on a degree? Does it still make sense to invest in this? And how are we going to answer to that value proposition in the future? So the expectations around openness and flexibility, definitely a new dimension. And then we have a total new aspect coming in. And that new aspect is new role players, the Googles coming into the higher education space. In other words, new role players, new game, new definition of what is accessible, new definition of what is sufficient, and so on. So how should we do that? Then in conclusion, the issue is, what should we do if we need to address these issues? How do we thrive again? How do we carry on? Unfortunately, it is not a one-dimensional answer. It's a multidimensional answer, and that multidimensional answer says we should, as higher education, revisit our supply and demand side. The demand side has changed radically. We should be able to understand students of the future. They need the demands in a better way to be able to ensure that we find a new synergy. Of course, hybrid, blended delivery, synchronous, asynchronous delivery, find a new balance between international and local market, enable us to manage the demands differently, is a must. Redesign curriculum, new types of qualification. I think Google is leading us in a new direction. So we need to understand that new types of qualifications, new processes, new ways of meeting competency requirements. I think a rethink of the business model is important because we need to understand again what is our niche. We need to understand how do we prioritize resources and what are the sources of income. So, in conclusion, the new context and the new relations between higher education, government, community, industry, and other higher education institutions must become a new frame of reference within which we find the new systems definition based on the requirements of the day. And this new role and this new awareness of partnership and sharing must become the way to go in order to take us forward. Therefore, short, long-term views and visions, not moving back to the past, is really what will bring us there.
Thanks, Alan. Colin, you're next cab off the rank. I'm not playing favorites here, but you know, I did study at Flinders, so. So I'm looking forward to what you've got to say.
Thank you, Melinda, and thank you, everyone. I was at home yesterday afternoon, prepping for an event in the evening and contemplating what I was going to say today and going over some notes and some statistics that I was going to share with you. And then something happened. Something happened that rocked me a little bit, and I thought I would share it with you instead. I was at home about 4 o'clock. My boys got home from school, 10 and 12. They were agitated. And they said that they'd met a crazy racist man yesterday. Right? And I was quite pleased they added the crazy piece, because that says they've got good judgment. They were sitting at a bus stop in Mitcham, waiting for their bus connection home from school. And some guy, a middle-aged white man with a dog, walked up. The dog started sniffing at one of my boy's feet, probably his uneaten lunch in his rucksack, right? One of my sons, Thomas, stroked the dog for a moment. And the man turned to leave, but then turned back, leaned in, and I should add, my two boys were sitting next to another boy from their school. The man leaned in, and he said, "Did you notice that my dog didn't go near the Asian kid sitting next to you? He's a good dog." And then he walked away, right? Now, I find that pretty horrifying. Possibly some of you don't find it very surprising. Probably it's not that surprising to me either. But I have to say, the idea that someone can verbally spit their bile at some young Asian kid yesterday in Adelaide, in Mitcham, right, I find quite worrisome. And I don't think that man was necessarily a racist because of the rhetoric that we hear from our government. But I don't think the rhetoric helps. We hear a lot of rhetoric around China, around trade wars, around COVID, around international students, frankly, and the risks and the threats and the financial impost that they've created for universities and the challenges associated with them. And that rhetoric, while I'm sure did not make that particular person in Mitcham a racist, I think it did nothing to temper his racism. And I think we need a higher caliber debate in this country around China in particular. Chinese Australians like that young boy didn't cause COVID-19. Chinese Australians like that little young boy did not influence the trade war that we may have with China. And certainly, I very much doubt he was a spy. So I do think we need a higher caliber of discussion, a higher caliber of debate, and I think it's incumbent on our government to ensure that they deliver that, because words actually matter. And it made me think of another anecdote, and I have told it once before, but I'll tell it again, because I think it's also important, because we hear an awful lot about universities and international students and the dollar value of them, right? And look, there is no doubt that there is a dollar value to them. Yes, education costs money, and yes, we charge international students. But international students bring another higher value to us, and I must say, I was pleased when the new education minister, Minister Tudge, acknowledged the importance of the soft diplomacy role that international education has played in Australia for now decades. At Flinders, we have, we're perhaps a little bit different to some universities. You'd imagine that all universities are stacked to the rafters with Chinese students. That's what the papers tell you. We have around 13% of international students at Flinders. Of the 13%, one-fifth of that, so less than 3%, would be from China. We have a diverse international group of students and have done for many years. The impact on those students and the soft diplomacy impact that Education Australia has on those students, I think, is very well reflected in one anecdote that I can tell you. In 2016, I was in Yogyakarta, the ancient capital of Indonesia. I was there because we were running, for our 50th anniversary, an alumni symposium. And maybe there was perhaps 100 people coming to that symposium. Our guest of honor was Minister of State Pratikno, who is a cabinet minister in the Indonesian government, still is. And he was to be our guest of honor. The panel was to be held on a Saturday. On the Friday night, there were 200,000 people rioting in the streets of Jakarta, which is an hour and a half's flight away from Georgia. And so it was pretty clear to me that we were going to get an apology from Minister Pritikno. Let's face it, I've been stood up for coffee by many politicians for a lot less than a riot in Jakarta. Hmm. And we did get an apology. His apology was, I'm sorry, but I've been in a cabinet meeting till midnight. I'm going to have to get the red-eye flight to Georgia to arrive there in the morning. I'll only be able to stay for 25 minutes because I have to go back to the airport to get back to Jakarta for a cabinet meeting at noon. Right? Just consider that for a second. Right? That is someone who was immensely committed to being part of an event for a university that he'd gone to a decade or two earlier. Right? Now, that's a relationship that we had built up with someone who had reached the position of power in one of our near neighbors, a very, very high position of power in one of our near neighbors. And he went out of his way to join us for that event. And when he spoke for 25 minutes. He was true to his word. And as he spoke, he choked up when he described how important his education in Australia at Flinders had been to his entire life thereafter. Now, we have thousands of international alumni who feel that way. Every Australian university has thousands and hundreds of thousands of alumni who feel that way. And 84% of the international students who come to Australia go home. They go home and they take with them this vision, this view, this understanding of us that, of course, we learn from them. And it builds alliances and alliances that last lifetimes. Now, that is an immensely valuable asset to this country. And I think that we diminish it at our absolute peril. Thank you.
Thanks, Colin. I'm going to ask Peter to come up, and just while Peter's making his way up here, you can start walking, Peter, I'll be quick. I did just want to highlight the piece of research that CETA did recently on permanent skill migration, and what we looked at was the skills mismatch between permanent skill migrants and the jobs that they ended up working in, and identified that one in four were actually working at levels beneath their skill levels, and that's a waste for us and a waste for them in so many ways. But The point I wanted to join to Colin's point is that one of the things that really quickly emerged when we started talking about this is that clearly a lot of international students come, they stay, and then they transition into the permanent migration stream. Colin's right, you know, a big chunk go home, and that's a great diaspora, but one of the things that was identified was that they were struggling to find jobs in their skill qualifications because they didn't have quote-unquote Australian experience. And when we started to talk about that, the thing that came straight out of the gate was racism. So I actually just want to join that dot, that there is an issue here that needs to be called out in terms of how people are seeing these very highly skilled individuals, and that's to our detriment and obviously also to their great detriment for people who've studied in this country for a long time. So I think there's some really interesting things to just explore there. Sorry to take your microphone, Peter.
Thank you very much, and thanks, Colin, for those important words. My speaking instruction says that I have 2 to 3 minutes, so I'll try to keep to 2 to 3 minutes. Thank you all for coming. Thank you to many of you whom I know are supporting all our universities through voluntary capacities because you subscribe to the fact that a strong, prosperous, and socially cohesive nation will be built on a good education system, which includes universities. The universities, they will contribute to a strong economy and therefore the possibility for a more prosperous community through what we call knowledge leadership. In my view, knowledge leadership has two essential components to it. One is to educate future generations through a lens of graduate success, personal success, and societal contribution. Two, add to our capacity to value add and meet challenges, as we've heard. The second component is to generate new knowledge that is deemed essential for us to end up in a better place than where we are now. And that happens through research, and especially when research is designed through an end-user need. When you do those two things well, and the students are educated in an environment where you look for answers that must be found but don't yet exist, you get graduates who are not seeing their education and time at universities as a prerequisite for their first job, but as a prerequisite for being lifelong learners who will be able to pivot and be successful whatever the world throws at it. This is what we're all trying to do. Because a lot has been said, I will just illustrate how we're trying to accelerate this in this particular case through our research efforts. At the university last year, we booked $60 million in contract research and consultancies, and as income for that year, which is a record year for us. And we also booked $288 million in coming payments. And that is because, despite what you hear, we are seeing a greater and greater realization between our people and people outside that partnered innovation is what will deliver fastest. We are on that journey. I hope you will join us on that. And when I talked about all the great people who are assisting us and the need to be informed by wider societal needs, I wanted to tell you that we have five incredible industry advisory boards in relevant sectors. They include agri-food and wine, defense and cyber, mining and minerals, creative industries, et cetera, et cetera. And they are chaired by industry leaders such as Andy Keogh, who is also the CEO of Saab Australia, Saab Defence Australia, Andrew Cole, CEO of Oz Limited, Rachel Healy, Joint Artistic Director of the Adelaide Festival. So I want to thank all these great people and you for contributing to what we have to do. Now, all this doesn't come cheap. It has to be funded. And if Australia, for one reason or other that I can't quite understand, believes that we shouldn't get international students back, we have to find another way of funding that. And of course, this is what our lawmakers have to contemplate. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Peter. David, your last cap off the rank. And then I've got lots of questions already, so it should be great. Thanks, David.
Thanks, Melinda. Good afternoon. I'm going to talk a little bit about disruption. Sectoral disruption of higher education in Australia through policy instruments has trickled from Canberra for about 9 years now. It's ironic. It's actually coincident with my arrival in Australia. Could be foreign influence. 10 years ago, investment in higher education was the largest component of the federal education budget envelope. You fast forward to today, and it sits third of three behind VET. VET is in second place behind private schools. Private schools now take the lion's share of taxpayers' dollars in education in Australia. That's a seismic unspoken shift in funding prioritisation. And by extension, it's a shift in the relative perceived value of higher education and the importance of higher education in the eyes of government in a single decade. While this deprioritisation of higher education was happening, universities were being actively encouraged to engage in the national interest in the education of international students. The former Federal Minister for Education, Dan Tehan, said in November 2019, "Australians should be very proud of our innovative international education sector. It's our largest service-based export and supports 240,000 jobs, business opportunities and economic growth. Our government continues to focus on the sustainable growth of the sector and attracting more international students." In February 2020, Australia closed its international border to China, stranding thousands of enrolled students offshore. In March, our international border was closed entirely and has remained ever so for over a year. These decisions are not being questioned. They were made for exactly the right reasons, for health reasons. They were made to protect our population. But they were also used to drive through alternative messages and to chaperone a major policy shift and funding shift. In April 2020, our Prime Minister told international students in Australia that they should go home, that no national support package would be forthcoming. Locally, UniSA put in place a $10 million student hardship fund because it was the right thing to do. By July 2020, the same once proud federal government was now publicly decrying the flawed model of Australian universities and their over-reliance on international student revenue. Income diversification, it seemed, was no longer a good thing. $9 billion of our nation's $40 billion international education value was lost in 2020. $1.8 billion of that loss was in direct revenue to universities. The $7 billion balance of loss hints at the scale of impact of an ongoing downturn in international education in the Australian economy. These losses will compound in 2021 while borders remain closed. Excluded from JobKeeper, an estimated 17,340 job losses were recorded in 2020 in the university sector. That headcount includes voluntary and forced redundancies, casual staff who lost their hours, and fixed-term contracts that were not renewed. 17,340 job losses, with no headlines, no outcry, no sympathy. Universities were apparently getting what they deserved. So what is the old adage? Never let a good crisis go to waste. To fix what was declared to be a broken business model, the government advanced something called the Job Ready Graduate Programme. I could opine that UniSA has producing Job Ready graduates for over 30 years now, and I could give you evidence for that, but that might take me on a tangent. The JRG was a masterful exercise in sleight of hand. While everyone was distracted by the bigger picture of the pandemic and the shift to online education and diminished international enrollments, over here the nation's national higher education domestic funding base was purposefully restructured. The major reform of the JRG was to reduce the level of funding the government invests directly in domestic higher education. The government pays less and the student pays more. Universities are now required to teach more students to receive the same amount of base funding. The JRG does not change our business model, it short funds it. It does not address the fact that private international revenue has up to now been used to support public core research and teaching, and that remains a case for major concern. Now, organisations under stress often tend to react for self-preservation. Jobs get cut and often costs are cut as well. Alternative sources of funding are sought and local disruption ensues. Locally, I would position, perhaps unfairly, the rushed introduction of Year 11 guaranteed entry schemes in such terms. Whether they're intended to provide some certainty to Year 11 students during COVID, even though schooling was only disrupted for 3 days in 2020, or perhaps to provide greater certainty of income to institutions during COVID, whatever the motivation, the pressure of performance gets pushed from year 12 to year 11. The equity of an objectively assessed examination system is removed from the equation. There's no moderation. SAIS no longer determines eligibility. A school set assessment does. Any ATAR will do, but the floor of entry of ATAR will never be publicly presented. The equity of admission and transparency of entry to higher education have been diminished, perhaps with good intent, but with consequence. It's a local level disruption precipitated by sectoral and global disruptions, and it's a very risky experiment. As we vaccinate our population, and outside of the revenue chasing in 2021, I think we have to contend it's now an unnecessary one. I'm not going to end on a negative though. Our state is home to excellent universities and some of the sector's most experienced vice chancellors and management teams. For our part, UniSA outperformed all expectations in 2020. We offset revenue decline through prudential operation and through the commitment of our enterprising staff, who in the last year went above and beyond the call of duty to ensure that our students were educated and employable, that our research was relevant and our community was supported. I cannot thank them enough for their efforts. Ours is not a broken business model. It's enterprising, it's committed to future collective success. The Minister was correct. Australians should be proud of their universities and the role that they play in society. Whatever gets thrown at us, we've shown ourselves to be unstoppable. Thank you.
Well, I think you'll agree that even before we get to questions, there's plenty to digest in all of those observations from our panellists. If you can see the questions that are being asked, we've got a lot of votes, and I am going to tell you now that I'm going to rejig the ordering. I'll make sure I get to the highest vote questions, but I'm going to try to structure a bit of a conversation if I can, and I'm going to ask a starting question, and I will ask for a show of hands on the floor, and we'll try to make sure we get the right balance as well if anyone wants to ask a question from the floor. So the starting question, I think that there's been a lot said about the importance of international students, you know, everything from the economic benefits to the significance of the sort of diaspora, if you like, and the connections that that brings, the relationships, the business opportunities, et cetera, et cetera. But I think perhaps one of the things that maybe some of us don't understand as well or have a clear line of sight to is what the universities have been doing to try to get international students. back on deck, if I could put it that way. And so that's one of the questions, you know, are universities doing enough to repatriate international students to Australia? And of course, there's the example of we've managed to get tennis players here, but we can't get the students back. So who would like to continue the sporting analogy and open the batting on that one for me?
I can see a couple of the Vice-Chancellors looking my way, so I'm happy to kick that off. There has been a significant amount of work being put into this from the sector and the state government. You would all be aware that there were plans to bring a pilot of 300 students, university students, back end of last year, which was unfortunately interrupted by our circuit breaker, as it's called, in November. Since then, the Commonwealth has released a preconditions and protocols document to return international students to Australia and has called on the states and territories to submit their plans to demonstrate how they could safely return international students. So that is the opportunity that, you know, the state is now looking at, working very closely with the sector. It is complex. It has been reported in the media that there is... there are, I guess, industry-led solutions being scoped for quarantine, so outside of the Medi Hotel, and of course they have to be extremely safe, meet the health protocols, you know, with the community and the safety of the community in mind. And there are other parts to this plan as well, the complexity around how we actually physically bring those students into Australia and to Adelaide as well. So there are plans underway, and I think there is certainly a huge amount of will around the table to make it happen.
Alan? Yeah. I think it's important we all understand we want to have students back here, but in the interim it is important that we also maintain our engagement and relationship with the international market. And for that reason, alternative ways of engaging with students and the visa arrangements announced last year so that students can start register, they can start and progress with their studies, and now the discussion, how much should they still do onshore in order to get the post-study benefits. So the whole issue from our side is, how do we continue to engage with the international market, use all the opportunities to enable students to register with us, to remain involved, so when the opportunity opens up that we're ready to engage those students. I think the risk is that we may lose some of our credibility in the international market while other countries like Canada and the UK and so on make significant progress, and we have to guard against that.
Yeah, sure. I don't need an answer from everyone. If you've got something that you want to add, otherwise we'll spend a lot of time on one question. We've got a lot of questions now. I'm going to turn to the floor if there's anyone who's got a burning question and wants to shoot their hand up. Microphone to the front, thank you. If you wouldn't mind announcing yourself and where you're from, please.
Thank you. Phil Honeywood, CEO of the International Education Association of Australia. The great disruptor in the sector, of course, Greg Craven, said the key fundamental problem for our public universities in Australia is they don't understand coalition speak. In all of this conundrum we've had, add to that the fact that we've got government by focus groups, and the editor of the Adelaide Advertiser has told me that they've never had a bigger pushback against the story when it comes to their promotion of international students returning to this state. What do we need to do to, number one, enhance coalition speak, number two, have greater community buy-in, if you like, in terms of getting our social licence to operate better understood by the wider Australian community?
I mean, coalition speak is an interesting way of thinking of it. Look, I think clearly there are issues around the international market. There are also issues around coalition speak for the domestic market too. Of course, I think with the domestic one, with the international one, sorry, as you asked, I think that, you know, from the public perception point of view, the majority of people, as I understand it, who have flown into Australia in recent months, the vast, vast, vast majority are not Australian citizens. You know, so we have this narrative that we can't bring any international students back until we've brought back all of the Australian citizens who are out there waiting. And we have students with, and yet the practical reality is we're bringing in, you know, tens of thousands of people who aren't citizens. And for some reason, they are prioritized. If you're a Hollywood superstar, you're prioritized. If you're a tennis player, you know, then you're prioritized over a perfectly valid visa holder who's a student. And of course, as the point was made by Karen earlier, you know, we have students who have been, who have been on hold, who have been studying in one of our universities for 2 or 3, maybe even 4 years, and need to complete to be able to move on. They've invested hugely in their experience, and there's a great danger that if Australia develops a reputation that says, you know what, when things get tough, they don't look after you, then I'm afraid students will turn away from us. And we're seeing it already. The numbers demonstrate clearly that applications to Australian universities from international students are down this year, or this is for 2021, sorry. You look at the UK, though, or Canada, the US, applications are up. And you think that's crazy. You know, who would want to go to the UK or the US at the minute with the COVID load that there is? The reality is twofold. One, the students are 18. They don't fear COVID, actually. They've either had it already, or if they get it, they're going to be fine, right? What they fear is signing up to a university they can never get to. So they will sign, they will, you know, come October time, if there is no signal in this country that says our markets will open up and our borders will open up and students can come back in, come October time, there'll be a wave of students who will be looking to the Northern Hemisphere, where the semester starts, the first semester of the academic year starts in October. And we might, you know, we might struggle to win those markets back.
Peter, I think you wanted to jump in as well.
Thank you. Yeah, I was fortunate to have a good relationship with Bob Hawke, and I asked him what they did to get these very strong economic reforms through in the mid-80s. And he said, we knew we couldn't get these reforms through unless the population understood economics better. So they ran an economic summit. And I think what has to happen for people to understand that it would be desirable to get international students back is to understand that in this state, most of the people who are in medic hotels, after they've been there for 14 days, they leave this state, maybe 90% of them. Whereas the international students would stay, and you would see that once JobKeeper comes off, there's actually a reason why all your best cafes and restaurants don't close. It's because there's a clientele that is contributing $2.2 billion to this state. So people should be outraged by everything being seen through a narrow political lens rather than what is in their broader interest.
So David, I'm going to turn this to you because I think, and I'm going to pick up a question here that we've got from the audience as well, the question I think that sort of sits beneath these observations is the numbers are staggering, the impact is staggering, the impact at an economic level is huge, but you're also articulating a really personal impact to students that sort of had a contract with us in a sense, right? So how come that isn't getting across? How come the political narrative, which is what's being put, is winning the day? And is there the need for greater collaboration across the sector, universities working together? Because I know plenty of businesses that are desperately reliant on that pipeline of skilled graduates. There's any number of stories. And so I think there's this question of why isn't this resonating?
Yeah, it's a great question, Melinda. I think the heart of this and the heart of Phil's question is about the social license and how acceptable it is to bring back international students, which is divorced from the appreciation of the economy. And, you know, we can engage in an economic conversation or we can engage in a racial conversation. There's two sets of political conversations going on. At every single state level and territory level, the importance of international students is being hammered home. There's not a single premier who hasn't said they want international students back for exactly the reasons you've articulated. And I know, you know, in terms of local anecdote, I went to my local coffee shop when the headline that the Tizer was running at the time about the return of 300 students was causing outrage. And I was asked by the barista, who I know pretty well, why were we pushing to try and bring back international students when there was a risk of infection? Right? So there's layers and layers and layers of education in this one. I said, mate, Jason, it's about 300 people on that plane is 100 jobs. There's every single plan that we bring back is 100 new jobs in the economy. So if we want to actually have an economy in South Australia, if you want to sell your coffee, these students need to come back. And when it's put in those terms, it's not a, you know, it's not macroeconomics, it's local economics. People start to appreciate it. Then we can talk about the fact that the students are sticky, that they actually, 40% of tourism is built on the back of international students. So yeah. We want to have a recovery in the economy, they're fundamental to it. But it's not helped when there's two layers of rhetoric. One is about the position of universities, and the other is about the importance of international students. And the two things are actually out of step at the moment. The role of institutions, the pressure from the centre against universities in this crisis is sort of blind to the $40 billion bigger picture. And we can't reconcile that as a sector. The negotiation to get the post-study work rights extension and the treatment of visas happened at a sectoral level. If we hadn't had that, we would have had no industry whatsoever. But the rehabilitation of universities in the public eye has to come through a change in coalition speak. And I think it needs to be about the direct contribution that we make to supporting the economy through the provision of education to international students.
So I think, let me paraphrase one of the questions here. It's got hands down the most votes. I fear that I'm walking into a political minefield. I'll say that now. But let me pitch the question high and then go to the specifics of this question, which is, would it be reasonable for people to be looking at the sector and saying, this has been a huge shock? How are you changing? To kind of go back to the challenge, this isn't going back to the old model. What does the new model look like, and how are you, as a sector, leaning into that conversation and offering up different solutions, if you like? And the specific question is about rationalisation, university rationalisation in South Australia. So who should I be directing this question to?
He texted the question.
Well, I think I should start because I was on the record in 2011 that I thought this would be desirable for the state. So one of the reasons why you're finding that we still, with a very low population base, benefit from having three very good universities is actually linked to the one measure which made it survivable to have three universities in this state, and that is exactly the international student revenue. And what I fear is that our competitiveness could become subscale quite quickly, and short of getting the economies of scale right, the three universities would at least have to think about what is it we individually do to serve the state's needs, but not triplicate it, because in certain disciplines, when others have scale, they can organise themselves very quickly, whereas we have to come together first with three subscale entities to then mount a nationally competitive bid for an opportunity. So, number one, we need to think about scale in what we do. You can have that through having the same activity distributed on a lesser number of institutions, or you can have the activity in an institution distributed on less diverse activities. But something has to happen if we don't have that very high-yielding revenue of international students. It's perhaps not known to many people, but on average, an Australian student, after they have made their very large contributions to their own education, on average will yield a university $20,000. And that's what it costs to actually educate a student. So there's nothing left for the research effort. Whereas an international student typically will pay $35,000 to $45,000 per annum. And that is why we're still viable.
Yeah, I think you and I have had a conversation about the economics of the sector before, and it was certainly eye-opening for me. Anyone else want to lean in on this conversation before I turn back to the audience?
I might say something. I mean, I don't know that a black swan event precipitates a requirement for amalgamation. I think that the rationale for rationalisation is not necessarily a global pandemic. You might say the same thing about Qantas and Virgin. I mean, maybe you should have just one carrier. Right, they're dependent on international mobility. You might say that we should have one tourism operator. So I don't think that the pandemic precipitates a cause for rationalisation in the sector. I think what it highlights is a deficit in the support for activities which have been funded by international student revenue income. Now, if we're able to offset those through cost-cutting or through international offshore education or different components of our own models, that's how we'll transform and preserve, I guess, the integrity of the sector. But if you are saying that because we've had a pandemic, we should think about merging institutions together, it's not necessarily the best rationale. I think that if there's going to be a rationale, it has to be to produce something which is stronger for the state, something which is going to be competitive on a global stage, and something which is slightly more bulletproof to black swan once in 100 year events.
I might, if you don't mind, Melinda.
Yeah, go. And then, if you've got another question, get ready. You can put your hand up now, and the mic can find its way to you while we're getting answers. So,
because your question started with, should the sector reconsider how it's structured or how universities are run? And then you led into the merger idea. Well, we've been on a journey as to how we're structured and how we're run. Mm-hmm. And we've been on that journey at Flinders for a few years now, 5 or 6 years. And we did a substantial restructure. I'm very pleased we'd done it before a pandemic hit because it's made it much easier for us. 2020 was not a bad year for us. We had a $35 million surplus. Our revenue target was $530 million, and we earned $530 million. Our international revenue target was $100 million. We missed it by $200,000. Our research revenue in the last 3 years has grown by 42%, 26% alone last year. So I actually think there are ways that you can make universities more efficient and more effective. And we've been on that journey, and we will be continuing that journey. This chestnut of mergers comes up quite frequently. I don't think I've used this stat before. I had to look it up again a moment ago. But, you know, we have this idea that there are too many universities in the state. It's interesting because we're joined by Alwyn today from Torrens University. Brought in by the last Labour government. We've got UCL, we had, who else? Carnegie Mellon. Mm. So there was a time when there weren't enough universities in this state, and suddenly there are too many. If you look at our population size, 1.7 million, yes. Scotland, where I come from, 5 million. There are 15 universities, right? By those criteria, we ought to have 5 here, right? When I was at Manchester and Manchester merged, we created a university that was 30,000 students. 30,000 students was the largest single university in the country outside of the University of London College system, the largest in the country. Flinders has 27,000 students already. Right? So there might be an argument for merger. There might be an argument to be had about the opportunities for the state through a merger. But I don't think it comes down to simple arguments around size necessarily or scale. I think it's more about how efficiently we can structure ourselves internally.
Yeah, great. We've got one question from the floor here. Again, if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself. And then, unfortunately, I'm going to have to call that as the last question. This could go on all afternoon, I'm sure. So thank you very much.
Thank you. David Penberthy, journalist with News Corp and 5AA. I'm actually asking this question more as a parent than a journalist, and it's about the quality and value of education for younger people in a post-COVID environment. Some of my fondest memories as an art student, both at Adelaide and Flinders, involve seeing people like Austin Goff and Trevor Wilson teaching about World War I, the history of modern France, the collaborative nature of Spanish classes down at Flinders University. So much of the richness of my university experience, both intellectually and also at a friendship level, friendships that I've retained to this day come from the physical process of being on campus. When I left home this morning to come to this lunch, my daughter, who's just started law arts at the University of Adelaide, was in a bedroom on Zoom doing a lecture. How do we make sure that the changes that have been brought about as a result of a pandemic don't become or don't result in a lessening of the richness
of the education experience for domestic students, particularly given that the added insult for them now is that she's probably paying about 30 times more for her arts degree than I did for mine in the late 80s.
Maybe I can start. So David, I think we do have to look at where in their personal development students are, and I think students who've just left high school have a different need for the mix of online and physical presence at the university than somebody who already has the first degree and want to advance their career with a postgraduate degree. So if you have a lecture online, I think that's defensible if the efficiencies and flexibility that the students get from that allows the university to mount more small classroom experiences of a more interactive nature. So you've got to look at the whole thing. It would be true to say that as students can access information which previously they could only get by a notepad when a lecturer was standing in front of them, they've actually voted with the feet and they don't go to lectures anymore, but they really, really appreciate small, more intimate classroom learning experiences, and more importantly, informal learning spaces where they'll learn from the students. And that brings me to what you said. Those relationships are formed when the students are co-learning. So I think technology is shifting it, but it's not all towards the bad.
Alwyn? No. I think this is the point that I was referring to earlier, that the supply and demand capacity of higher education institutions must be addressed. The whole discussion, and there's a very recent report from one of the larger audit companies, specifically talking about student experience, including customer experience, learning experience, and personal experience. So it's a matter of a new approach to design the learning experience, a new approach to facilitate the engagement between lecturers and students, students themselves, and also a different way of giving them access to material. So I think the approach around this, and if we look at the feedback from students, we continuously monitor to make sure what is your learning experience, and then make sure that we moderate effectively what we assess to determine what the outcome of the learning experience is. And at this stage, we find that our younger students especially appreciate the flexibility in the learning opportunity. They do indicate that they want to have more personal and social engagement. So that is the campus part of it. But that is something that we can plan around. But I think we should accept that we probably will never move back to a full face-to-face model the way in which we had it. We'll have a much more flexible model with much more diversity involved, with a total different design of the learning experience and the learning process that students have. And that is an exciting opportunity, and I think this is what we must understand, that the new world of work is actually asking for some of those skills that we can build in this way. So it's a new ballgame, but it's an exciting ballgame, and not for a single moment doubt that we are able to deliver the same and even better quality of education through this.
Thanks. I'm going to have to cut our conversation short now and ask Marie Wilson to come up and give a vote of thanks. While Marie's walking up, I will just say I've been enjoying watching my oldest daughter and her study habits at university. She doesn't go to the lectures, she watches the videos, but she listens to them at 1.5 speed so that she can get more done. I can't keep up, but it is the new way, apparently. Marie, over to you. Thank you.
And could I just try to save my job here? Because there was something I should have said. The issue of university mergers is not the prerogative of vice chancellors. It's about institutional strategy and what their governing bodies decide that they want their CEOs to do with their universities. And there are probably many people who wouldn't agree with my views, that they were personal views.
Thank you. Well, I think that the issue of higher education and its contribution to the social and economic development of Australia sits squarely within the remit of the Council for Economic Development of Australia, particularly with its emphasis on development for good. And I think we've seen that play out in today's discussion and presentations, that there is a hunger for development and continuing engagement with knowledge, knowledge transfer, and knowledge creation. These events are always some of the larger events that we hold in South Australia. And I think our speakers have brought a number of different perspectives to that, from the macro policy and economics of higher education, both domestically and nationally, down to the level of what the individual experience of racism, careers delayed, careers denied, hunger in some cases, and interaction at a personal or technological level. We've heard about disruption and innovation, challenges and resilience. Those are all the things we expect from the higher education. And those are all the things that I hope that everyone in this room is ready to support as this sector moves forward in what are, as our vice chancellors have noted, very challenging times. On behalf of the State Advisory Committee, I'd like to thank our moderator, Melinda Salento, the vice chancellors, and Karen Kent, chief executive, and on behalf of all of us, offer a vote of thanks to their distinguished and challenging and interest-provoking session today.